Asia Pacific currents.
News and labour issues from the Asia Pacific region.
We strongly condemn the police that arrest the protesters.
Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock.
On Community Radio 3CR.
Workers of the world should unite to fight this greedy capitalist.
Brought to you by Australia Asia Worker Link. Good morning and welcome to another episode of Asia Pacific Currents here on Community Radio 3CR. I'm Giselle Hanna.
And I'm Kieran Bennett.
And we are taking you through to 9:30 this morning. In the second part of today's show, I'll be bringing you a speech delivered by Jamil Sawalmeh. He is from ActionAid Palestine. And so we'll be listening to that speech that he delivered. That is in the second part of the show. But of course, Asia Pacific Currents is brought to you by Australia Asia Worker Links. You can find us on the web, all the w's.aawl.org.au. We're on Facebook and Substack. Look us up on those social media platforms. We might go straight into news from around the region.
Time for news from around the region indeed. Let's head over to Vanuatu, where the Vanuatu Teachers Union has warned that the right to strike for workers is at risk because of a new bill going before Parliament. The government of Vanuatu claims that the proposed bill will modernise dispute resolution, with the existing law to be amended to introduce stricter penalties for strike action. Under the new law, individual workers will face up to 4 years imprisonment and fines of up to $4,250 US for participating in strike action. For comparison, the average monthly salary in Vanuatu is $600 US, and workers are facing a combination of a rising cost of living and growing casualisation. The VTU secretary this week noted that while the law contains harsher penalties for striking, it also complicates and prolongs the process around conciliation and mediation. The union has called on Parliament to properly scrutinise the bill as it runs contrary to international labour standards to which Vanuatu is a signatory.
On Tuesday, Mehmet Türkmen, the head of the United Textile Weaving and Leather Workers Union, which is abbreviated to Birtek Sen, he was acquitted 58 days since being arrested. Türkmen was detained during a raid on his home in mid-March following a complaint by the owner of Sudmahala, a carpet manufacturer in the southeastern Turkish city of Gaziantep. The owner had lodged a complaint with the gendarmerie after Türkmen addressed workers who were striking over unpaid wages. Before this week's hearing, Birtek Sen, that's the union, the members of that union, workers and relatives of Türkmen gathered for a protest outside the Gaziantep courthouse in a demonstration that also drew support from labour representatives and politicians from other parts of Türkiye, as well as from European countries. Türkmen had been charged with inciting the public to hatred and hostility for saying the laws do not apply to the wealthy in his speech. The charge was later changed to spreading misleading information, which his lawyers argued was aimed at silencing a Labour leader. While the prosecution called for a prison term, the court dismissed the case.
Let's head over to South Korea, where there's some interesting strike action likely. The Union of Kakao, a major tech conglomerate in South Korea, announced this week that it will begin collective action next Wednesday to protest a breakdown in wage discussions. With worker management conflicts surfacing simultaneously at key companies in the Kakao community, tensions are rising across the Pangyo IT industry, known as Korea's Silicon Valley. On Monday, the Korea Federation of Chemical, Textile, Food and Food Industry Workers Union Kakao chapter stated that wage agreement talks for this year at five companies had broken down and that it filed for mediation with the Labour Relations Commission to be heard on Monday. Beyond compensation, the union has cited long working hours, an inadequate response to alleged workplace harassment, and requests for members to consent to forensic examinations of their mobile phones as the source of the conflict.
Public Services International and UNI Asia Pacific both issued statements this week condemning the Nepalese government's plan to ban unions in the public service, expressing concern for the welfare of workers in Nepal and calling on the government to withdraw this decision. The statements were issued after the Nepalese government began to issue ordinances to target unions, particularly civil services unions, healthcare unions, and water supply unions. PSI, UNI, and other affiliates have reiterated that the actions of the Nepalese government are illegal, not only under international law labour conventions, but also according to provisions in the Nepalese constitution, which guarantee the right to form unions and collective bargaining. PSI added that governments attack public service unions when they intend to privatise and reduce public services. Furthermore, there is clear global evidence that higher union density reduces inequality, limits oligarchical power, improves public health, and increases access to public services. Nepal's recently elected Prime Minister claims his measures are aimed at depoliticising government institutions.
Yes, I love that depoliticising by getting rid of labour rights. Over in Indonesia, 51 people were detained during a May Day protest in front of the House of Representatives building in Jakarta. They have now been released, according to the Jakarta Legal Aid Institute. They were among more than 100 people initially detained by Jakarta police on May Day. The LBH public attorney highlighted procedural violations during the arrest process, including the confiscation of mobile phones belonging to protesters without clear reasons being given. In addition to this, LBH also noted allegations of arbitrary searches of individuals wearing black and that the majority of the detentions were due to police sweeps, with some people reportedly picked up before they had even arrived at the protest. In addition, several protesters claimed that they had been directed by uniformed officers to board buses headed for a concert venue, only to be taken to police headquarters instead. LBH launched checks of the legal status of several detainees, but were unable to find any who were considered suspects of a crime. As a result, more than 50 of the detainees were released on the grounds that they were not in fact accused of breaking any laws.
Our final story for the morning is from Thailand. The Bangkok Bank Trade Union successfully reached a collective bargaining agreement with Bangkok Bank this month after 30 rounds of negotiations that began in October 2025. One of the major gains is financial assistance, equivalent to 6 weeks' wages, plus an additional cost of living allowance of $618 for all employees. Maternity leave was increased from 98 to 120 days and paternity leave for childbirth from 5 to 15 working days. The gains also included wins in medical coverage, worker insurance and provisions for cell phones. The negotiations took place during a period of continued profit growth for Bangkok Bank, with the bank seeing a 9.9% increase in net profit compared to the previous year and was recognised by Time as one of the world's best companies in 2025. Despite these strong financial results, the bank initially refused to grant the additional cost of living allowance sought by the union. Their collective persistence and solidarity ultimately led the bank to reconsider and approve the additional allowance. It is 9 minutes past 9 o'clock here on Community Radio 3CR. I'm going to go to some community announcements and then our feature story for the morning.
Don't miss Future Country. The country wrote an NGV First Nations Commission's exhibition, now showing at NGV Australia. See new work by 8 emerging First Nations artists from around Australia who've been guided by esteemed industry mentors to present their most ambitious works to date. From weaving and photography to sculpture and possum skin cloak making, experience these powerful works in this free exhibition, open daily until 13 September. Learn more at ngv.melbourne.
A 3CR supporter.
We're going to go into our feature interview for the morning. You are listening to Asia Pacific Currents here on Community Radio 3CR. This is Jamil Sawalmeh, Action Aid Palestine Director, and this is his recent speech.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming tonight. As Michelle introduced me, so I work for Action Aid in Palestine. and I was born and raised in a refugee camp there in the West Bank. Lived all my life in the West Bank, been traveling across the world, also continuing that advocacy on behalf of the Palestinian people. Let me start by saying that we truly appreciate and acknowledge all the solidarity and the support from the Australian public. What you have done in the streets of Australia has actually reached the people of Palestine, and it's highly appreciated. And we would like that to continue, because that's the only way we maintain our human conscience together, and we maintain to engage on issues related to injustice, occupation, and oppression. So that is truly appreciated. I would like to speak to you tonight. I don't have a speech, but I have a testimony from the ground. I live in the West Bank, but I've been working in the humanitarian sector for the past 25 years, worked directly in Gaza from 2014 to 2021. And the recent, let me just pick up on one of the points that Michelle mentioned. It did not start in October 2023. And it is very important for us when we address the question of Palestine is not to take a snapshot approach to history. Because it's very easy to isolate events and look at their direct repercussions in light of what is happening. It's very easy to consume the news when it's a very fast, vicious cycle of 24 to 48 hours and things just disappear. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what is happening in Palestine has been happening in the past 100 years. Some of the practices that Israel is doing now actually inherited from the British Mandate and the British colonialism prior to 1948, the rate of when Israel was established and our Nakba as Palestinian refugees. And myself, I have a direct link to that. My family was expelled from the city of Jaffa on the Mediterranean in 1948 and ended up, I think 60% of the family ended up in refugee camps in Jordan. My part of the family ended up in refugee camps in the West Bank. And this is to say, when we look at the recent events, unfortunately, much of what was happening in the past few months does not make it to international media. And based on the fact that the world has been comfortable with a very fake ceasefire in Gaza, there's a false ceasefire, and everybody was comfortable with, you know, at least at the international level, that since we have a ceasefire, that means things are becoming normal in Gaza, which actually is not the reality. And the only thing that have changed in Gaza is that people stopped dying at scale. So Israel stopped massacring people in huge numbers. However, the killing continued. It happens every day. And of course, the continuous systematic obstruction of aid and aid workers into Gaza still continues until the moment we speak. There's a very systematic, deliberate obstruction. Some reports indicated that Israelis were actually calculating the minimum amount of calories that people need to survive during an engineered famine and starvation in Gaza, and they were allowing aid in comparison to those minimum calories. and much, much, much more. But it's very important also to understand that the humanitarian situation in Gaza has not improved after the ceasefire. We haven't seen any significant improvement in any way. People were not returning to their homes because they've lost them. And as Michelle said, 90% of the structures in Gaza have been demolished, completely erased. And that includes everything, not only homes and schools and churches and mosques and universities, everything. And we haven't seen that aid was transported at scale, despite that the ceasefire agreement clearly states that, I don't want to go into numbers again, but we would like to say that before this war, Gaza was in need for 600 trucks per day of humanitarian aid or commercial goods to survive. Today we're seeing anywhere between 60 to 70, in the best case 100 trucks being transported into Gaza for a civilian population who are cornered in 45% of the total area of Gaza and in need of everything. People have lost everything completely. And it's very important for us to maintain addressing that and speaking about that. Because the humanitarian situation in Gaza is not going to improve even if there is a full ceasefire and a full opening of the crossings. We're talking about total devastation. That's going to take us years and years to rebuild and reconstruct. And by when we talk about reconstruction, I think it is always easy for us to imagine the physical side of the reconstruction. When we talk about rebuilding schools, rebuilding homes, water networks, electricity, roads, and everything else, the infrastructure to be rebuilt, that's the easiest part of the reconstruction. But it's very important also for us to consider what the human reconstruction means in the context where people were going through the horrors of the genocide, and that they have reached the level of devastation that we see now. What is our responsibility to stand next to these people, to hold them by the hand, and rebuild them as human beings, rebuild them as society, because the social fabric was torn apart also through this genocide. There are many things that they will surface when people start catching a breath and coming to terms with what they have been through, what they have suffered. When they look around, because at this moment everybody is on survival mode. Okay, throughout the genocide, everybody was just trying to dodge the next missile or the next attack. Now I think everybody is trying to secure the next meal for their family, or figure out how they do a makeshift shelter for themselves and their families. But there will be time when these people will be faced by the reality. They will start looking around and try to understand or come to terms with the level of destruction and devastation around them. That's going to be a devastating moment for these people. And we need to be there next to them. We need to be there to accompany them through the journey of the human reconstruction. Again, that's very important for us also to keep in mind. And again, I think it's very important for us in the shadow of all of what's happening in Gaza is not to forget the situation in the West Bank. Because Israel, again, have used this opportunity to further expand its settler colonial project in the West Bank. And they have direct investment in the settlement movement in the West Bank. Now we're talking about nearly 1 million Israeli settlers living in the West Bank. Taking over Palestinian life, so putting Palestinians under effective military occupation, under control, obstructing any sort of meaningful life for Palestinians, erecting 1,000 checkpoints across the West Bank since 2003, October 2003. And these checkpoints represent a daily challenge for Palestinians. They represent a daily struggle for those who need to commute, including myself, where I commute from Ramallah to Bethlehem to work in my office in Bethlehem. And a journey of 1 hour can take anywhere between 2.5 to 3, 5 hours sometimes. You return back because the checkpoint is closed. And let me just give you one example of the sad reality or the difficult reality we face when we commute in the morning, for example. When you queue at the checkpoint, all the checkpoints are all around the cities and the towns and the villages of the Palestinians in the West Bank, and sometimes they lead to roads where settlers also move. And most of the checkpoints that leads into the settler traffic, they're closed from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. and closed again from 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. So that means that there is a deliberate effort to regulate the Palestinian traffic that gets into the settler traffic. So the checkpoints are closed when the settlers are leaving for their work, leaving for their school and for businesses. So they give them the liberty to move around until everybody has got to where they want to be, and then they open the checkpoints for the Palestinians. So it's another effective apartheid practice being implemented in the West Bank. And in that context also, it's very important to really talk about the state-sponsored terrorism, the state-sponsored terrorist settler movement in the West Bank that is being armed. I'm sure some of you might be aware that 200,000 machine guns were distributed to Israeli civilian settlers in the West Bank, and 300,000 more licenses are being granted now by Minister Ben-Gvir, Minister of Internal Security in the Israeli government. And those weapons have been used. So we're talking about 1,100 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank since October 2023, including 230 children. These weapons are being used to attack Palestinians, to destroy property, to confiscate more land in the West Bank, to attack livestock, to attack livelihoods of the Palestinian farmers living in the different Palestinian villages and communities across the West Bank. But the most important point to make here is that there is zero accountability for these settlers who are sponsored by their state to destroy Palestinian life and to destroy any glimpse of hope that Palestinians still have in their future in Palestine. Zero settlers were taken to court because of what they have done, including those who have killed Palestinians, including those who have torched a family southeast of the city of Nablus, killed all the members of the family, they torched their house and burned them alive. Zero accountability. And unfortunately, the world just turned a blind eye to all of this. We don't see this, doesn't make it to the international news most of the time. And again, in the context of this, all of this was happening for the past 100 years. What has changed in the last 2.5 years, it was condensed. We have seen the ugliest manifestation of it. But in the West Bank, land confiscation started in 1948. Displacement started back then. Punitive house demolition started back then. Arbitrary detention started back then. It was happening all the time since 1948. It's just when the Palestinians erupted against all of this, the world started to realize that maybe there is something wrong there that needs to be addressed. Maybe there is an occupation that needs to be addressed. Maybe there is an oppressed nation that have suffered what they have suffered, and there have been outcries of Palestinians across the world for many, many years, but very little meaningful engagements were done by third states, by governments across the world. In addition to that, of course, the Palestinians always hope that international structures, international law structures would be just, would do justice to Palestinians. We have gone to the International Court of Justice, we have gone to the ICC, we have gone to the United Nations. There are resolutions of UN Security Council, in addition, of course, to resolutions from UN General Assembly. None of that was respected. None of it. And then there's still us this, you know, all of what we have established as a humanity after the Second World War is just fake system, or a system that only applies to the third world countries, does not apply to the West and the developed countries. There is hypocrisy at the international level. And unfortunately, Gaza became the mirror that showed the world its ugly face, that showed the world its double standards in terms of dealing with what's happening in Palestine. What we are seeing now, even in terms of the agreements that Israel has signed with the Palestinian Liberation Organization in 1994, and in Oslo Accords, the Palestinians were asked and demanded to respect these agreements, which they did, but Israel did not respect them at all. So as one of the most important aspects of the 1994 Oslo Accords is to freeze the settlement expansion in the West Bank. And what happened since 1994? Double, triple, quadruple, more settlers, more land confiscation, more settlement expansion. Zero respect. There was supposed to be an opportunity for the Palestinian Authority to thrive between 1994 and 2000 in a hope to realize the Palestinian dream of having a sovereign state on the borders of 1967, as, of course, suggested by the West. The two-state solution is a Western-made solution that did not actually take into consideration the rights of the Palestinians. But all of this was not respected. Israel did not comply with any of either international law, international norms, or the accords and the agreements they have signed with the Palestinians since 1994. And this has brought us to modern-day Palestine, where it is very difficult for the Palestinians to maintain hope. And it's very difficult for the Palestinians not to be frustrated. It's very difficult for the Palestinians not to be thrown into despair. Because everything they've tried, it failed. So we tried the peace negotiations for 30 years. And at the end of it, we just realized that Israel was actually buying time. It was just another effort to distract the global community with an illusion that is called the two-state solution, and go into negotiations while settlements were expanding, while settlers were being armed, while land was confiscated, while Palestinian life was continuing to degrade in the West Bank by attacking livelihoods, by obstructing movement, by continuous military attacks, military incursions across the West Bank. And you have seen what happened in the north of the West Bank. It's a massive military campaign against the refugee camps in the northern part of the West Bank, in which we have seen the largest displacement wave since 1967. Today, there are 52,000 Palestinians that were kicked out of their homes in the refugee camps in the north of the West Bank, with no prospect for them to come back, because Israel has already bulldozed their homes in these camps. And they are trying to create a reality and a status quo on the ground where they want to get, you know, to a point where the Palestinians would think that there is no future in Palestine. But unfortunately, Palestinians are very resilient, and they've managed to maintain, I would say, the bare minimum when it comes to hope. And that what keeps everybody, you know, alive in that particular part of the world. But again, how long? For how long can the Palestinians actually continue to live that type of life? How long can they maintain to be oppressed? And how long until we see another October 7th again happening in Palestine? So these are the realities that we are facing. And in the middle of all of this, let me just also speak about how ActionAid responded to all of this. And I think we are one of the very few international organizations who have realized that the question of Palestine is not a humanitarian question. It's not about providing aid. It's not about keeping people alive under oppression and under occupation. It's not about distributing supplies and materials to those who are displaced. It's about a political commitment. It's about a commitment that we need to have as an international organization to address the root causes of what's happening. It's to talk about occupation. It's to talk about respect of international law. It's to tell, you know, the truth about what's happening on the ground. It's a genocide. We have to explain it. We have to justify it. It's a genocide happening in broad daylight, broadcasted on live TV across the world. So I think that gave us a very unique position when it comes to our situation as an international organization. It brought us closer to the community. It brought us closer to the people that we serve, and ensured that we continue to be a principled organization. We continue to be an organization that live up to its identity. We are not pro, you know, plain language or neutral language that does not actually do justice to those who are oppressed or the victims of what's happening. We have been bold. We have been issuing statements. We have been talking about what's happening. We've been supporting our local partners to have a voice and to speak for themselves about what's happening. Of course, in addition to all of that, we've been very much engaged in providing humanitarian aid, because we need also to be the lifeline of the people. We need to keep people alive. We need to provide food, we need to provide shelter, we need to provide psychosocial support, we need to provide shelters for women, we need to provide shelters for children. So I think we've mobilized everything we can as a federation and made it available for our local partners to respond. Because those who have stayed on the front line, the partners that we worked with, they stayed there, they never left. They moved with the people. They were displaced with the people. They were moving from one corner to another. And every time they moved, they established themselves.
We will have to leave that there. There's only a couple more minutes left of that speech, so it was drawing to an end anyway. But that does bring us to the end of another Asia Pacific Currents here on Community Radio 3CR. Thanks for tuning in this week. Make sure you stay tuned in to 3CR for the rest of the weekend. And of course, tonight is the Gabriella fundraiser, so make sure you get along to that. I'm just trying to bring up those details for you. It is tonight at 6 o'clock at the QV Centre, which is...
It's the QV Women's Centre. It's the old women's hospital
on Lonsdale Street, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Tickets are $85, so make sure you get to that tonight. But that is all for me, Giselle Hannah.
And me, Kieran Bennett.
Coming up next is Palestine Remembered.